Welcome to episode 7 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is Dr. James Fielder, who teaches political science at Colorado State University in Fort Collins and goes by his call sign, Pigeon. He also serves as a Marine Corps University non-resident Krulak Fellow. He's done that for the past three academic years, and as I understand, he's just re-upped for another hitch. He's also the director of professional educational game for Mobius Worlds Publishing. Pigeon earned his PhD at the University of Iowa, and his current research focuses on interpersonal trust and emergent political processes using tabletop and live-action gaming as natural experiments, which we're probably going to spend some time talking about. So, as with all episodes, let me offer the disclaimer that the opinions and ideas of the speakers today do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity and should not be construed to do so. So with that as the traditional organization, welcome Pigeon.
Hello. Hello.
So as we were talking beforehand and giving you an idea of how this podcast generally runs, one of the first questions I ask people is kind of how you got your start in this area of study and research. Full disclaimer, he and I taught for several years at the Air Force Academy in the Department of Political Science, and he retired a few years ago, which meant he had a chance to reinvent himself and do something completely different. Yet you continued in the academic sphere and then got into this interesting area, which again we'll talk more about in terms of the relationship of games and exercises. But how did you decide that this is what you wanted to be when you grew up, assuming that you're at that point in your life?
Yeah, whoever really grows up, right? So yeah, and actually I can go way back to my formative years, where a combination of my mother worked at the Washington Post for 36 years, and she worked in the classified ads department. But as a youngin, she would bring myself and my brother to Washington Post with her a lot. And we got to meet reporters, editorial cartoonists, journalists, basically different people working at the press, you know, got a tour as a child of like the printing area. And I got in the habit of then as a, you know, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, actually going through the newspaper. Maybe I started with the comics, you know, keep it easy. But I got in the habit of very young age of reading the newspaper, and combine that with my grandfather would come and watch him watching the news back in the day when you actually had to turn the channel by turning a dial. And I was just fascinated by international news reporting, again, as a very young age, kindergarten or first grade, second grade. And I basically grew to appreciate the narrative. And I, moving forward into my undergrad where I did a bachelor's degree in history, like I wanted to hear the tale. And I know that, you know, history and current security studies is a tale that's constantly being retold. It's a tale where I don't know where the story is going to end, but I still want to have that. I'd like to see the human condition being played out in real time. So that would be a way back.
Yeah, well, very, very interesting. People have, I think, a lot of different studies talked about that human beings are naturally storytelling animals, and we understand things better through story. The folks that do the useful fiction project, Peter Singer and I think August Cole, they came to the Academy a few months back and gave an interesting talk that would have dovetailed along those lines. But not to interrupt. So that was you as a kid in the press rooms of the Washington Post. And then what did you do after that?
So yeah, fast forward to about to finish my degree in history at the North Carolina Greensboro, trying to figure out what to do with my life. I had thought about joining the military in high school, and my parents weren't opposed to it, but they said, maybe you should think about going to school first and then think about it. Well, what you know, I was going through the student center, and an Army recruiter had set up a booth and offered me a deal I couldn't refuse. He said, if you join the Army, we will pay off your college loan. And 3 months later, I had my degree in hand, started enlisted then, and they kept their end of the bargain. They sent me to school to be a Persian Farsi linguist and then do electronic warfare with the 2nd Armored Cavalry, and they paid every dime of that loan. But then while I was in the Army, I remember being selected to, when they were grooming me for a sergeant, they said, can you teach a couple of sergeant's time lessons? And this is part one of my journey into game studies. I said, absolutely. I'll put together a whole training plan, and we're going to do both butcher block instruction, and then we're going to go out in the woods and actually do a scenario. So I do the instruction. We go out. I had some volunteers who set up to be the Red Four, and we went out there. We practiced everything we did, and it was basically a live-action role-playing game, two squad-size elements. But everyone had a lot of fun. They said, huh, maybe a fielder can do another sergeant's son training. And then once you get that stink on you, I started doing, you know, first squad level, then helping to design company level items. Then when I switched from the Army to the Air Force found out that I had some experience in designing exercises. And so I got into doing war game design, exercise to design, training, development, and whatnot. And it was the Air Force many years ago that I ran my largest ever game. I developed, scripted, executed, and data collected on a wing-level exercise at Ellsworth Air Force Base that also included first responders from Rapid City, and it ended up being like 5,000 participants. And it was as a combination of one, everyone had a they said it was awesome training. It was very visceral, and they enjoyed it. But then goes back to it was training focused. Like we met all these objectives, and the folks were able to practice what they learned. So yeah, that's the game design portion of it. The next stage, part two, was my first tour of the Air Force Academy. When we were talking about social capital and the block in American government on associations.
Yeah, the rubber put in the book.
Yeah, exactly. So Blood Edmondson, Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, Robert Putnam. And then one of my students stood up and said, so if social capital is best developed in person, like you see, meet someone, you see their face, you shake their hand, you work together in person, is it possible to develop the same type of trust online, like in a game such as like World of Warcraft or EverQuest at the time? And I thought, huh, that's an interesting question. Let me go look into that. Fast forward since 2006, in addition to designing training exercises, now I also study how players build political institutions inside of game worlds. How those institutions mimic what you find in real life. And then in turn, how does it affect the player when they come back out of the game? Like, does it change them in some way? I'll say that broadly speaking, yes, it does. Players who learn confidence inside of a game space where it's technically risk-free, but a well-designed game feels real, well, they learn that confidence. They come out into the real world, and they're now more likely to be participate civically, to engage in voting, to socialize, to engage in real-world groups as opposed to just online interaction.
But they use that online interaction, as I hear you describe that, as their way to test the waters, to build some skills. And it sounds like it goes right back to your, you know, Army training courses for enlisted troops and sergeants that need an opportunity to apply the things that they may have been trained or read, but unless they do them, even in a game context, they're not ready for the real world. Is that basically your pitch?
Yes, exactly, 100%.
So if we consider this in the national security arena, this explains, this is part of the background of why war games and simulations have been part of the development of security policy and defense plans for probably, I'd say, 100 years. If we think back to, at least in terms of what I'm familiar, your military history background may be better than mine, but certainly in the 20s and 30s, that was the era where the United States was engaging in wargaming to try and figure out what's the next war going to look like, and in particular those plans and studies that went into shaping the operational plan for the Pacific. If I'm correct, a lot of that was worked out around a wargaming table.
Yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, the I apologize. I can't remember which admiral said it. I'm 90% sure it was Admiral Nimitz, who said that the Battle of Midway played out almost exactly like they expected, based on gaming out a similar scenario, except for kamikazes. They didn't forecast that, but otherwise, they said Japan was making the moves, quote unquote, that we expected them to make, and in turn, we countered them with our own.
Which, from the perspective of Midway, that was probably correct. It wasn't the kamikaze did not present themselves until later, a little bit later in the war, another year or two, I think. So that was something that was a development within the context of the war itself. But
I did want to add one thing important. I want to note, though, that war games by themselves don't prove anything. Like, if you go in to play a war game and assume that the outcome of the war game is actually how it's going to happen, that's not the case. It's more that a war game generates hypotheses that you can test with other experiments. And if you play multiple games with multiple different participants and you start getting the same outcomes over and over again, that might be telling in a way. And it's certainly going to build your confidence as a team to work together, but it's not going to necessarily prove that the outcome will actually happen.
Yeah, they are an instrument to study and explore ideas. They are not necessarily guaranteed for predictive behavior, and they can be biased and influenced. There was an article several years ago, probably 10 or more years ago, or the exercise was 10 or more years ago. I think it was a general, was it Van Riper? That was part of a war game in a golf setting. And he played, you know, a very aggressive and creative red team that didn't go along with the intentions of the DOD organization that was hosting the war game. And they reset it a couple of times because he kept winning. And they didn't really want him to win. Probably learning occurred, but it wasn't, you talk about narrative earlier, it wasn't the story they wanted to tell, because blue forces, the U.S. were intended to win, and Riper cleaned their clocks, I think, at least twice until they started taking things away from him and said, no, we're going to knock you down. But it was, again, for those that were part of the process, it was an interesting way to explore the challenges. So those are history. Let's move ahead in what you're doing now, right? Because history buffs, we could spend time talking about that, and you know, we'll collect people along the way that would like to hear that. But as the application of these tools to current problems go, what are you currently working on as a way to use a gaming environment where again, people maybe not gathered around a trust a table to build trust, they are engaged at a distance, thanks to the various options that now exist for multiplayer online experiences and such. What are you applying this to now?
Oh, so at first I got bad news for you, and then I got good news. The bad news is I did recently recorded a brand new online course for Colorado State University called Emerging Threats in International Security. It's for our new graduate certificate in national security. Off the top of my head, it hasn't been deployed yet.
Okay.
But all the courses have been recorded. One of the nuts I tried to crack for this was because it's asynchronous. I thought I really wanted to do a game for it. And working with my curriculum designer, it didn't work. So for that go, I'm like, I wasn't able to incorporate a game into it. Now I'm recording another course for CSU Online, though, Comparative Authoritarianism. And this one, I'm asking me again in 3 months how it went, but I'm making another concerted effort to try to integrate some sort of gameplay into a course that doesn't meet synchronously. So thinking in terms of maybe it's going to have to be some sort of turn-based game, since, you know, students are logging in at different times. And whatnot. They're going to be reviewing the material at different times, so I'm going to give it a shot. That's the bad news. The good news is I'm currently the co-editor of an upcoming volume on using short games in the classroom. It's a follow-on volume to another book I was a co-editor on, Simulations in the Political Science Classroom, Games Without Frontiers, Routledge, published in 2022. That volume had theory, design principles, and a collection of games that ran anywhere from a single lesson to a multi-day. This new volume I'm working on is every game in the book has to be playable in a single lesson or less. And it's going to be less theoretical. It's going to have more of a collection of stuff you could pull off the shelf and deploy right away in a political science undergraduate classroom.
So something accessible for current teaching faculty, they can just grab that and then use it directly applied to their current lessons.
Correct. Yep.
Hey, let me go back a second for those that heard you use the terms, and I think you kind of explained them as you went along. But for people that didn't teach during the pandemic, the distinction between asynchronous and synchronous classes is important for the challenge you're trying to adapt games to. Asynchronous means students are not meeting at the exact same time. They log in, they work on their own schedule in accordance with the syllabus. But synchronous is everybody in the pool at the same time. And that's a different opportunity, but also a challenge with the asynchronous model. So the turn-based method you were talking about is part of the necessary solution there, correct?
Correct. Yep.
So as an example of a type of game that you would use for a particular political or security problem, can you give an example what that would look like and what your expectations are that someone would get out of that game? As you said earlier, they might be learning this for the first time in a virtual world, but how they might then apply that in the real world.
Okay, so this is a speculative example, if you will, but it still uses real-world principles. For the last 3 years or so, in my large Political Science 131 Current World Problems course, I've done a end-of-course exercise that lasts 4 days, where the students form teams of six, and they can be a state, they can be intergovernment organization, or they can be a non-government organization. And I actually let them design their own teams using the DIME model, diplomacy, informational, military, economic. Yeah, for an NGO, how they re-spin it slightly differently. And so they design their own teams, they send me their team structures, and then I script a zombie apocalypse game based on what their teams are built like. And it's run entirely in the classroom, but I actually use Discord, which is a free communication tool.
Yeah.
And what's convenient is I can sit in front of the classroom to have all the teams listed on one side of the Discord, a server page, and all these different channels for chat. And I can improv the entire game from the front. But even though the students can also log into Discord, it's absolute pandemonium in the classroom. Teams like trying to talk to other teams, you have students running around, students throwing things. And I'm testing them to say, first, are they using course concepts? So like I'll get to points in a second. I'm giving them more like kudos or advantages if they can successfully demonstrate they're using a course concept. And the course is largely based off of international relations and comparative politics fundamentals. And I tell the students also, I know how the scenario starts. I have absolutely no idea how it ends. It all depends on what the students do. So remember, now picture this. Again, me sitting in the front of the room, hunched over a laptop. And on the back screen behind me, I'll have like zombie movie clips playing. I might have some music playing. And then there's a room of 150 students just absolutely going to town with each other.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, by having it in a way, someone might ask, don't you use a real world scenario? Like, why do you make it a zombie apocalypse scenario? The reason why is that there's a sense, like if it's, even though I don't grade them during their actual participation in the game, there is some hesitancy when they feel like they're going up against a undergrad. But if I make it a speculative opponent, like I make it robots, aliens, zombies, there's a larger willingness to take risks. And I want them to feel like they can safely take risks and try strategies without a fear of failure or moral issues. Well, I mean, there's still going to be moral and ethical issues for other reasons, but now they can face this opponent that it's not the same as like saying, oh, we're going to war with China or going to war with Iran. We're going to war with, like, against a fictional entity. That entity could still conquer us if we're not careful.
Yeah, I was going to follow up on that because we've had other discussions in the past about these hypothetical fictional scenarios can be useful because they kind of strip away some of the baggage that people are going to import with regard to a scenario with a real world player and allows them maybe to focus on the more fundamental, the purity of the problem in front of them and not get distracted by whatever preconceptions they bring. And that can be very useful in these settings. And in the defense of using the zombie model, before the pandemic, the CDC, if I remember, had put out, I think it was the CDC, it was preparation guides. And they used the zombie metaphor or narrative as, a crisis. You know, don't worry about what the crisis is. It's just assume a crisis. Let's call it zombies. What would you do? And there are certain, if you think about theory, there are certain fundamentals that you're going to speculate that any crisis is going to require you to do, regardless if it's a real-world antagonist or is the fictional zombie environment. It gives you the blank slate on which to then start composing your response. And the moral, ethical, political issues, that they're all there. They're just not skewed by preconceptions that, adversary X in the real world is going to behave this way. Because maybe that they're not going to behave that way. So you can free people from those enforced misperceptions by bringing in a fictional element. So, yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
So how did the students respond to that? Did they like it? Did they come up with anything interesting?
They love it. And they've come in, they'll have all sorts of, I give them very, very few rules to follow. So they'll be coming up with innovative solutions to the problems. I will come up and ask, hey, are we allowed to do this or that or the other? Also, nowhere in the rules do I talk about forming alliances or new IGOs. But they will come up and say, hey, can we form treaties? Can we do this? I'm like, yes, exactly. That's the kind of collaborative, cooperative behavior that I want to see in the students and in practice, again, practicing what they've learned in the class. This is where I want to get back to the grading portion of it. And this is what helps having the students having the fun factor, if you will. Actually, I should talk a little bit about what fun means too. I'm adamant when it comes to using games in the classroom that you should not grade the game itself. Because a good game always has an element of chance. And so a student's grade shouldn't come down to chance. So they could get all the way up to the end and fail. Or maybe they win all the way at the start, something like that. So I say, no, you know what? Your team could fail in a hail of gunfire, but you will not be penalized for it during the game. Rather, I have them write an after-action report, a reflection essay, where they answer a series of questions and then provide me feedback on what to improve about the scenario. And that way, so they can take risks, but now they're additionally reinforcing what they learned by writing it out and thinking about, like, viscerally, intellectually, and emotionally, what did it mean to them? And that helps it stick. And then they get their grade for it. And I make it so it's worth their after-action report for this exercise is not it's not peanuts, I'll put it that way. Their overall grade isn't going to suffer tremendously because of this essay.
Yeah, that's why you ensure that learning actually occurred, because these are tools for learning, not ends in themselves. If you're really good at playing the game, okay, fine. It's what did you learn from the game that really matters?
Yes, exactly. I wanted to say, if I may, mention the word fun right quick. So I know there might be some folks out there who are like, you know, when it comes to a training event, how much does fun matter? Well, I use Ralph Koster's theory of fun, and he's another game designer. It's his definition of fun is all it is the brain learning new things. The brain is engaged. The brain is like, it has something new in front of it, something novel, and the brain wants to solve it. And you can have very, very, you can walk into a very tense war game and look around and go, these people don't look like they're having any fun at all. They're tired. They're angry. They're bitter. They're howling at each other. But their brains are on fire. Their brains are like living it. So, yes, I do, in a way, I do want my students to have fun. My definition of fun is I'm engaging their brain. And I'm engaging it pointed towards a well-defined course objective.
Which is, again, what makes these simulations, games, and such useful teaching tools, is because you get the students' brains to engage on problems in ways that just handing them a reading assignment wouldn't. You know, if I assigned a class in the courses, Causes of War course, and had them read all about World War I, they would come across the theories about how arms races or alliance formation contributed to that war. But if you put them in a simulation where they're playing the roles of individual countries and they see opposing blocks form and they think, oh, I need to have a countervailing alliance, or, you know, my opponents here in the Central Powers are building up their militaries, I need to do something about that, then they're living this. I put this in air quotes, you can't see on an interview here, but they are going through a process which stimulates their brain, and they react in ways that demonstrates the theory that they read about on paper, but they're, again, doing it themselves, and they're making their own connections as they sort of wrestle with the same problems that the historical example, or we could put it in a modern context, whether it's a zombie apocalypse or some, again, antagonist actor in the international system, is just a different way of getting learning to happen in the minds of your students. So very interesting. Any final words on that as a tool? Because I'm looking at the clock here for the target we usually try to keep to, and this would be a fascinating discussion to have. We've had similar ones offline, but I'm trying to give an insight into this for the people that have listened to this podcast. Any final thoughts about games as a teaching tool, or shall I move on to the question and see how you deal with that?
Just one final thought, if I may, and that's partially because I like trust being built in person, and also partially because I can't code worth beans. I'm largely right now a proponent of like either in tabletop games where, you know, all pen, paper, you pit it, the act of the player actually picking up cards or handling dice or touching the map, a tactile, visceral experience that kind of gets their mind primed for the game, and then physical interaction with other players, which I can partially mimic using Zoom or Discord, but not perfectly. The other end, though, is I have considered trying to use some sort of large games like Minecraft in class.
Yeah.
But every time I think about it, I'm thinking, it's so much easier just to sit down with some dice and some paper. But I'm trying to figure out.
And in some ways, more satisfying. You get that human interaction that's important at a certain level. So when we're saying games here, just to clarify for the folks who have been listening, games are not necessarily having people play video games. Things can be drawn from that, especially the larger online ones. And I think you did some research on that a few years back. But the in-person component is important. Well, again, we could go on and on about this. Fascinating stuff, and hopefully this inspires other people to think about it, having listened to this little bit of overview here. But let me pivot here and ask you the question that everyone gets in these episodes, and have you pivot to look ahead. And in the next 5 years, What change or trend in international or domestic politics, economics, law, technology, or even culture will have the greatest impact on national security, in your opinion?
All right. So I already told Darren prior to this interview, I've been pondering this question a great deal. And I'm going to, there's probably a better term for it. One of the Darren or our listeners probably already knows the term for this. But borrowing the title of a magazine that I flipped through on occasion called Hack Space, and the whole premise of the magazine is basically the maker movement, you know, 3D printing, using Raspberry Pi, using Python, using to taking like spare parts laying around the house to build robots or small computers. So I'm going to take that magazine title and just call it Hack Spacing. And the idea of that having this confluence of miniaturization, confluence of interconnectivity, confluence of using just commercial off-the-shelf pieces of parts or COTS to develop new weapon systems that don't have to be expensive. And I'm using Ukraine as my first example, saying how, you know, we think in terms of like unmanned aerial vehicles like a multi-million dollar Predator system. But in Ukraine, hey, we just bought a UAV or drone off the off the shelf, modified it a little bit, hooked it up to a controller, put out some spotters, and now we can actually launch weapons into Moscow that are difficult to detect. You know, we've had decent success rate. So I look at that. Certainly, VBIEDs cause a tremendous amount more damage in Iraq and Afghanistan. But watching how Ukraine is putting together these off-the-shelf weapons, just using radar parts and combining it with internet connectivity to power project, that's something else. My second example, and this is recent, this is as in, I just read about this 2 days ago, even reading the U.S. Navy doing experiments, the Fifth Fleet, where they're coming up with, here you have a budget of like $200,000, develop a weapon with it. Like, you know, instead of buying a billion-dollar destroyer, we just took this money and built a very small, low-profile sea drone. There's a better word for that, I'm sure, to keep track of Iranian forces, to potentially, you know, launch an unmanned weapon against Iranian forces, that sort of thing. And the end result of the article was, look what we can do with so much less money. And it brought it, like, what does that mean about, you know, major shipyards and major defense systems? And what does that mean about the acquisitions process? Uh-huh. Like, maybe we don't need all that. So, I don't know. So I guess, yeah, I called it the Hack Spacing. Just hook something up to the internet using parts you have laying around, and you can challenge a major power with it.
Definitely seeing that unfold in the headlines today. And sometimes it's made out of cardboard from what I've been reading of late.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you. Again, this has been hopefully great food for thought for everyone, and ideas that people will pick up and maybe explore on their own. So thanks, Pigeon, for taking some time to talk about that and your current research, your interesting answer to the question here. And thanks to everyone who's been listening to this 7th episode of the N3SP podcast. We hope you've enjoyed hearing about games and their application to the study of international relations and politics, which is the focus of the research being done up there at Colorado State University. And hope you will stay tuned for future episodes. And in the meantime, if you'd like more information, please go to our website, n3sp.org. Goodbye.